Good afternoon and welcome to UK Column News. Now, this is special UK Column News today because, I'm actually away in London recording the Midi on Trial event for Froome Stop War. So this was pre-recorded on Tuesday the 17th of October. And I'm delighted today to be joined by Dr. Graham Downing. Welcome to the programme, Graham.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here again.
So we're going to do a special on vaccines. We're going to begin by showing a short video clip. Just tell us a little bit about who we're about to see.
Well, this is just a health professional just talking about having the whooping cough vaccine. And then after that, we'll start to discuss that vaccine.
Okay, well, let's have a look at that.
I would recommend that a pregnant woman gets her whooping cough vaccine. Adults tend to lose their immunity to the pertussis bacteria. So, you know, you may have been vaccinated as a child and your body forgets how to fight it. And in the early part of the illness, it looks like a cold. You know, you won't know about it. And before you know, the baby gets it. So I recommend the whooping cough vaccine. Whooping cough in a child can be a life-threatening illness. So the mother gets vaccinated, she will not pass it on. She will not get the infection, she will not pass it on to the baby. I actually advise the father to get the vaccination too. I ask all the family members, the extended family members who are going to take care of the baby to get the vaccination. I think by getting the adults in the house and even the children vaccinated, you know, you're doing a big service to the child, because any child who gets whooping cough needs to be in the hospital, especially if it's, you know, an infant or a neonate. Because they can get really very sick from it. They can turn blue, they need oxygen, they need to be in the hospital, which is not a cool thing. You would rather be home with your baby and enjoy your baby rather than have him or her be sick. Yeah.
So, Graham, in principle, that all sounds fine. So what's the issue here?
I mean, there's several things there, really. One is, how about looking at the research? Because absolutely, look, you know, if you can come up with a wonderful drug or vaccine or natural treatment is absolutely safe and does what it says on the tin, and, you know, more power to your elbow. But what astonishes me is that you have a senior physician there or consultant that speaks with such gravitas and patients listen to that. And, you know, and there's no reason initially why you shouldn't listen to that. And they speak with such power about, you know what, you must get vaccinated. And what she's describing there is something called ring vaccination, whereas you bring a baby into the world, so everybody around that baby has to be vaccinated in order to protect that baby. And as she stated there, she stated, because then the mum who gets it won't get infected and won't pass it on to the baby, won't pass an infection on. And the problem with that is that's just not true. And many studies have come out. There's another recent study now, I think you've got up on screen, and it shows clearly that not only does this vaccine not stop infection, it actually doesn't stop the transmission of infection. And I've talked many times about this, that it doesn't stop the transmission. It's kind of not designed to stop the transmission of infection. So, and worse than that, you can become what's called an asymptomatic carrier. In other sense, you can become infected, but you don't look that infected, and you can actually spread the disease to somebody else. And the last thing you want to do is vaccinate a bunch of people around a baby with that, because you'd be putting the baby at risk based on the things that we just said. Now, others would argue about that, but I think this paper is reasonably clear now.
This paper is from the School of Public Health, and it's entitled Resurgence of Whooping Cough May Owe to Vaccines' Inability to Prevent Infections.
No, absolutely. And even though what you'll find in all these journals, they won't ever come out and say, OK, well, it's failed, let's move on. It's always may, if, but, more research. But this is building on a body of work now. And the reality is that it's, you know, it doesn't really work. It doesn't really do what it says on the tin. And, you know, there's many reasons why that is. But the biggest problem I find with this is that these consultants just aren't reading the research, and they're just spouting out the same old diatribe all the time. And it's very dangerous.
And we've got this one then. The headline is Life Ruined by a Single Vaccine. All this father wanted was to see his newborn, and instead this happened. So that's quite an emotive headline.
Yeah, this was, I think it was in Australia. Now, this was a while ago. This is about 2012. And, you know, this isn't an everyday occurrence. This is a relatively rare occurrence, but it does show the idiocy and the problems with this kind of mentality where you're not looking at the research. This man went to see his newborn child. But before they would allow him to walk in and actually see his own child, you know, the hospital police said, no, you've got to be vaccinated. He was vaccinated, but they said, well, we're going to make sure you're up to date. So they gave him a booster of some sort. The usual stuff, diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, you name it. And unfortunately, that's what happened. His immune system attacked his brain and his spinal cord, and he became quadriplegic. Now, I think to some extent he's recovered well, although still disabled and can't work. And he's struggling. He's having to sue the state in order to get some money to live with his family. But the point is here, even if you believed that these vaccines worked, the reality that you're going to vaccinate the guy and then the second later he walks through the door, suddenly he's going to be have the benefit of that vaccination, it's just utter nonsense. And on top of that, the science shows very clearly, as I've just alluded to with the study we mentioned, is that it doesn't work anyway. So this poor chap is paralyzed, and I said initially a quadriplegic, for absolutely nothing. And the whole theory of ring vaccination is based on work from the 70s, 71, 75, some papers, I think it was Fogg, Millar and Henderson. Henderson was on one of the papers, saying that you need to do this type of thing. Now, in, I think it was 2003, I mean, it's Professor Kaplan from Harvard looked at this paper and said, the pivotal graph that shows that if you ring vaccinate and that helps to eradicate infection, they were looking at smallpox, he said, it's nonsense. He said the graph has been altered so that the data fits the hypothesis. You know, in other words, it didn't fit the hypothesis, so they've altered the graph. Now, others argue about that, but he's very clear. And when you look at it, it's very convincing. So this kind of concept of ring vaccination is built on this kind of data that is suspect. That's the very least you can say about it. One other thing, the guy Fogg who came up with that, he's now advising Bill Gates. So the guy that they've basically said, well, this graph is nonsense. You know, you've twisted it to fit, you know, your hypothesis. He's now one of the guys who's behind Bill Gates. And Bill Gates obviously is on a massive crusade around the world trying to vaccinate everybody.
Just looking at this image, the father who's been damaged apparently by the vaccine he was given, has the young baby lying on his chest. Last week, Graham, we were highlighting the fact that the United Nations had acknowledged that a polio vaccine that had been given in Syria had caused a polio outbreak in Syria. I mean, what are the risks actually to the baby of the medical profession allowing the baby to lie on the father like this since he's been damaged by this particular vaccine?
I mean, that's an interesting question. I think the type of thing that he's got going on with him, it's not necessarily he's going to be infectious. He's that he's had an autoimmune reaction. And you can get it from having a high temperature as well. He's had a particular type of autoimmune reaction, and it's attacked his brain and his spinal cord, and that's why he's in a terrible state there. But you can get vaccines. What they do is called reversion, is that they'll vaccinate, and the actual and they say, well, we've disarmed the virus, so it can't reconstitute and it won't be a problem. And I've always said that's not always the case, because I've looked at the literature, and they revert. So what can happen is they can revert back to what's called a wild type inside the host, and then the host will then defecate, and then that can get in, and that can cause an infection with someone else, which is usually what happens. And that this has been known for many, many, many years. It's not an unknown thing. And then the point is, wherever you go with this, you rob from Peter to pay Paul. You can't, this kind of perfect world that they want, where there's no disease at all, and there's going to be these wonderful vaccines, there's going to be no problem, it just doesn't exist. And we've kind of gone into this twilight zone now where there's so much bias in this research, and there's so much bias and inculcation in terms of the physician just not believing that vaccines don't work, that we end up with these silly situations where this man has been damaged for having a vaccine he doesn't need, and also would have made no difference anyway, because it would have taken him 5 minutes to walk from having it to see his baby. So it's just a nonsense, you know, and they really do need to rethink what they're doing with these things.
Okay, let's have a look at this one here. Why the increase in protactin deficient pertussis ? And what it says here is that this is from the Society of Healthcare Epidemiology of America, and it's saying patients who had received at least one dose of vaccine had a significantly higher odds of having pertussis compared with unvaccinated patients. The investigators concluded that the greater odds of having PRNB pertussis when fully vaccinated according to the schedule suggests that vaccinated persons have greater susceptibility to PRN strains compared to PRN plus strains. You know, it seems to me that every time we have you on this program discussing this subject, you're presenting more and more medical papers demonstrating this, and yet people seem to be acting on a faith basis rather than scientific basis.
I mean, it's a really difficult subject, and I do feel for those that are involved in the area because they're under huge pressure. They've got to come up with something. They're under tremendous pressure of research grants. I'm sure they're in fear of losing their job if they don't turn in the right result. And, you know, don't get me wrong, they may have some honest data. We're not saying it's completely dishonest. However, academic research does show that over at least 90% of the papers that are published in the medical literature are just not reliable. I mean, that is an astounding percentage. And what your paper just showed there is if you get fully vaccinated or get vaccinated with the whooping cough vaccine, you're more susceptible to a different type, to a different strain. And I've been, you know, banging on about this for years, telling people. I mean, my main area of interest now is kind of we've moved on a little bit from the vaccines. We're talking lots about artificial intelligence and the brain and that kind of stuff. But, you know, I still have a kind of foot in this, and I still keep an eye on this. And what's really sad is, and that's the only word for it really, is that these things didn't need to happen if they just applied common sense and actually just looked at the literature and just applied it in a proper, rigorous and scientific way. And unfortunately, what's happening with the clinicians, they're just not connecting to proper literature. They don't know how to find the literature that's not biased. And we're living in this kind of twilight zone where at some point they're going to have to wake up to this and say to themselves that the vaccine train isn't the great thing they thought it was. And they really do need to rethink this in an honest fashion.
Well, look, over the last week or so, as I've been driving into the office in the mornings, I've had BBC Radio 4's Today programme on telling me that I've got to have a flu vaccine. I must have a flu vaccine. And you have come across this leaflet, which is being distributed about the flu vaccine. Well, you have concerns.
Yeah, I mean, on the left there is the official kind of, someone brought this to my attention. This is the kind of official letter that goes out to parents and says, look at this wonderful vaccine. It's very, very safe. And look how it does. It reduces GP visits by 94% for what they call influenza-like illness. It reduces, I think it was hospital admissions of flu by 93%. And it's all wonderful. Go get it. And then someone's produced this infographic, which and said, what do you think of this? Now, I looked at all these papers in quite a great detail and was very disappointed with the vaccine. And oddly enough, an odd bedfellow is the CDC in America, which is a massive, massive public body in America that is absolutely pro-vaccine and has actually been found lying to defend vaccines. They've even come out against this vaccine and says they think it's rubbish and doesn't work, to paraphrase. But this leaflet is very interesting because if you put one either side and you said to me, which one would you think would give the proper informed consent? In other words, which one would you read and would actually inform you about this vaccine? The one from the NHS actually, I think, is grossly misleading. And the one on the right, whoever's produced this, is actually far more accurate because figures like 94% reduction in influenza-like illness visits to the GP in children, the actual figure is negligible. And the reason that that's the case is because the NHS leaflet is using what we call relative risk statistics, and they're very misleading when you use relative risk statistics. The other one, the actual infographic on the right is actually using correct statistics, which is what's the actual risk reduction. And to give you, just to try and, without confusing people, try and explain that, if you imagine that you live in somewhere, in a population of, say, I don't know, just using the extreme, 100 million people, and two people got ill out of 100 million, and then you went and gave a vaccine, and then miraculously only one person got ill next year. A relative risk, you would use the figure that two people were ill before, now only one person is ill. You say, wow, it's a 50% improvement. But the reality is when you look at the statistics, the actual risk reduction is nowhere near that. It's infinitesimally small because what you've got to look at is in that population, 99,999,000, and blip, and two and eight rather didn't get the infection, and then the next time you did it, the difference was only changed by one person. So what you're actually doing is you're only improving the risk by one part in 100 million. So, I mean, try and work the percentages out on that. I mean, it's just ludicrously small. But depending how you present the statistic will depend how people will perceive it. And it's been presented there, I would suggest, grossly in a gross misleading fashion, because it gives the impression that this is the wonder vaccine. And the reality is, when you look at the actual risk reduction, like I said, it's minuscule. And I think they've got it right when they've said it's negligible.
If we can just focus on the flu vaccine itself in general. I mean, I'm not a medical man. You are a medical man. But my perception of flu is it behaves in a similar way to the cold virus, in the sense that it mutates regularly. The vaccine is never the vaccine is never the current iteration of the virus. So you know, how effective can it possibly be?
Well, this is the problem. And one of the problems is having reliable data. And as I've just explained, and given you a statistic from the academic work, is that most papers are grossly unreliable. And we're now pointing out one version here, how information is distorted. And so having proper data to work that out in the first place is a problem. But the reality is, you're absolutely correct. You get this strange change. They can undergo various changes like antigenic drift and different other technical names. So trying to pitch the right thing for the right virus, and even if you get that right thing correct, doesn't always mean it's going to work in the patient. And you know, then you've got other problems, because, for example, here you've got an attenuated live virus. This is, you know, the live viruses are problematic. So they've kind of weakened it, and they're giving this to kids. Well, 1 in 10 of them, maybe 1 in 11, it says 1 in 10 here, about 1 in 10, 1 in 11, will get an influenza-like illness from that, which is no good. And then studies show that people who aren't vaccinated can acquire that virus. About 1 in 41, 1 in 42 can acquire it. So if you're in a room with a load of people who are vaccinated, you may well acquire that virus. So there's and then if you look at the amount of numbers that are needed to treat, when you look at some of these statistics, you have to treat thousands of people so that one person has an alleged improvement in risk about from not getting flu. And if you then multiply all those numbers by the numbers I've just said, 1 in 10, 1 in 11, 1 in 41, you end up creating more ill people than you do than the ones you're allegedly preventing. And if you look here, it says there's an increase in respiratory outbreaks in the school since they introduced this vaccine by 2,630%. Well, if this thing's so great and it works, which obviously we're looking at our interpretation is it doesn't, then why are the respiratory outbreaks going up in schools? So it's a nonsense. And, you know, fine, if you've got proper data and it actually shows it does what it says on the tin, fine, but it doesn't. And I don't think they should. I mean, I don't think there's any evidence to support the continued use of this. And in fact, I think it's showing that they should stop it. But as I said, try derailing the vaccine train, and good luck with that one.
Well, look, this is a good point. So just getting back to the polio vaccine in Syria for a second, the UN report, if you remember, said that as a result of this outbreak of polio, which was derived from the vaccine itself and wasn't a naturally occurring outbreak, that 33 children had been paralysed as a result. Now, the people that are promoting the vaccine agenda, the Bill Gates of the world, for example, would argue that, well, in the larger scheme of things, a lot more people's lives have been saved by this. But if I'm understanding you correctly, and the data is so poor in the scientific literature, actually there's no evidence to demonstrate that, or am I reading too much into that?
No, I think that the problem is most clinicians will they never investigate vaccine science. The ones that do will look at the papers and just take, they'll read the abstract. They won't actually look at the data and interrogate it, and they won't look at the history. And even the both retiring editors of the New England Journal of Medicine, I think The Lancet, two of the most leading medical journals in the world, upon retirement said a significant percentage, if not most, of the stuff that's been published in those journals is crap, basically. It's just not. It's so biased, and it's pretty obvious if you're going to spend $1 billion on a drug, trying to get it from design to out there being used, or a vaccine, whatever, then you're going to want to make sure that that paper says what you want it says. And you, and it's human bias. It's human nature. So you, this is why I said it's so difficult. So you have to go in and look and really interrogate the literature. And there are, I mean, if you look at polio, for example, one of the things that they, that I didn't realize, I looked at, well, damn, I thought, I can't believe they've done this. What they did was they changed the criteria of diagnosis of polio. You have to understand that FDR, the president of America at the time, I mean, his whole presidency, the main part of this was to tackle polio, because he had polio himself, allegedly. So when they developed a so-called vaccine and he found out they actually increased the amount of cases, they caused an outbreak of it. I mean, he was obviously fuming and said, you better sort this out. And then the reality is what they did was, one of the things they did is they changed the diagnostic criteria. So they changed the rules. So they've got this one criteria of diagnosing polio prior to using the vaccine, and they've got another one afterwards. And the criteria massively reduces the number of people diagnosed with polio, regardless of the vaccine. And that's just one of the kind of like tricks and things that goes on with this. And for example, to bring it forward in India, as you may know, the Bill Gates Foundation, I think it was, that was pushing the polio vaccines in India, and in the end they've tried to kick him out, is that they said they've cleared polio, but in its place, you've got over 50,000 kids with something that looks identical to polio, but is twice as deadly. And they call it non-polio acute flaccid paralysis. So you start getting this gerrymandering and this this newspeak and this kind of changing things and changing criteria. And things like Guillain-Barré that we have now, and things like transverse myelitis, would have been called polio many years ago. So this is what happens. They keep moving the goalposts and changing things around. And this is problematic if you're really trying to study this seriously.
Yeah. Okay. Now, we have another little clip here. It's from InfoWars, and it's just a short extract from this. I recommend people go and listen to the whole interview. We'll talk about the implication of this in 1 second.
The schedule has grown, but I think what a lot of people don't realize in a closed space like a NICU is they've decided that we need to vaccinate these babies on time. 2 months after they're born, bam, there it goes. Mm-hmm. If this baby could be 4 months early and still supposed to be inside their mother and weighing 3 or 4 pounds and
wow,
getting the same amount of vaccine as a 200-pound man, and I've sat in a room with all of our on-call staff, physicians, and practitioners, like, oh, wow, this is so embarrassing. This 25-weeker never actually required a breathing tube and going on the vent, you know, after he was born. He was so strong, but we gave him his 2-month vaccinations and he got intubated last night. Ha ha ha, oops, how embarrassing. Like, it's funny.
So, Graham, Michelle wrote in there basically saying that premature babies are being given their vaccine schedule based on their birth date rather than their full term date. And she's implying that they are suffering badly as a result. I'm not aware that in any other area of maternal care that anything would be done to a child based on its birth date if it's premature rather than its full term date. That's, to me, that seems a pretty incredible situation.
Well, yeah, I mean, to any sane human being that's kind of got 2 brain cells working, at least, you'd think that would be the case. It's atrocious. You've got, thank God we don't have mandatory vaccination here, but I think there's an advisory body there. They suggest that you use use it with preterm infants. Babies, but then they said, "Oh, well, look, it's known that they stop breathing when you give them a vaccine." They're so plugged in. Well, we've got to protect them. They've got no protection. We've got to protect them of all these infections. And don't get me wrong. Look, if a baby gets infected, it can be very serious, and we're not suggesting that. But there's a paper. I think you've got a slider at some point, and it shows that they did a study on it, and they looked at nearly 14,000 premies, we call them, and they showed there was increased problems, they stop breathing. And they also showed that the increase in sepsis evaluation. So you're looking about infection. So the very thing that they're giving in order to prevent life-threatening episodes like stopping breathing and getting an infection, they're causing the damn thing. And it's all based on this on this kind of cult idea about vaccination being so wonderful and so perfect, based on data that is heavily biased, and also based on manipulation of data that we've previously discussed. And what I'm saying is they've got to straighten all this out so they can actually look at it properly and say, does it do what it says it's supposed to do? And more people are starting to doubt that it does.
Well, let's just look at that, because that paper, this is from the Vaccine Knowledge Project, which is Oxford University. It says it's easy to assume that premature babies cannot cope with vaccination because their bodies are undeveloped. Premature babies can cope perfectly well with vaccines, and their immune system will respond to them. However, because premature babies are underdeveloped, they are particularly vulnerable to infectious diseases. This makes it even more important that they receive all the routine vaccinations at the recommended time. It's not a good idea to delay vaccinations or miss them altogether. And in bold text, it says it's common for premature babies to have temporary stopping of breathing following vaccination. Very premature babies born before 28 weeks should have their breathing monitored for 48 to 72 hours after their first set of immunizations. So they seem to be saying it's perfectly okay.
Well, apparently so. It's perfectly okay to take a healthy baby that hasn't got any infection, that is allegedly been looked after by professionals. They are then going to give it something to prevent a life threatening event like stopping breathing. And the thing they're going to give, they're worried about it because it could stop them breathing. Go work that one out.
Yeah, these days with budgetary pressures on the NHS, special care baby units generally do a particularly good job. Can they be expected to be monitoring absolutely every second, 24 hours? Is that realistic in present financial circumstances?
Well, I think they'll have monitoring. I'm not an expert in that field, so I declare that, but obviously they have monitoring, there's basic monitoring equipment. But the point is, it's almost like a religion. They have this belief. I think you said it before we went out, this kind of faith that it doesn't matter what happens, they don't see it for what it is. So they're causing the problem they're trying to prevent, but they don't see that. They just see the need to have to keep doing this intervention. And the data are, as I said, really risky that all of this is based upon. And this is the problem we have. And this is the reason why I bang on about, please, can we get a level playing field and people actually start to honestly look at this so we can avoid injuring little babies and avoid injuring fathers are going to see their kids based on gobbledygook science, quite frankly.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's just have a quick look at what the NHS advice on this, vaccinations for premature babies. Excuse me. It says it's especially important that premature babies get their vaccines on time from 8 weeks after birth, no matter how premature they are. It may seem early to give a vaccination at such a tiny baby, but many scientific studies have shown that it's a good time to give them vaccines. So that's pretty definitive from the NHS.
Well, there you go. They're all singing off the same song sheet. And as you heard that specialist nurse there say, they knew this was going to happen and they would prepare for these babies to stop breathing. So, I think they need a bit of common sense here. And this study, which I think you may have up now, was the study, I think it was 2015. And highlighted it there. Even though it says that all these extremely low birth weight infants in the NICU, which is the neonatal intensive care unit, had an increased incidence of sepsis evaluation, which is infection, and increased respiratory support and intubation because they stopped breathing after routine immunization. Their findings were, our findings provide no evidence to suggest that physicians should not use combination vaccines in these infants. It's got to the point of insanity. Any rational human being would look at that and say, well, you really do need to rethink what you're doing. And unfortunately, they appear to be blinded to what is in front of their own eyes, as far as I can see.
Yes. And Graham, just to end for today, the question then has to be that a lot of the issues here with regard to public perception of vaccines arise because the media is not asking questions on this and is merely following the party line, if you like. And in fact, the media horrendously critical of anybody that is asking questions about vaccines. So that is a major part of this picture, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think if you, on that first article we put up, that poor chap, was it Ben Hammond, who became quadriplegic after they forced him to take a vaccine to see his own child. His wife was attacked, and I think she had damage to her spine and a broken jaw because she spoke out and said, "We have no money. Can we please get some compensation?"
She was physically attacked.
And also, I believe so, yeah. It says it in the article. Right. And also, there were police raids on their house, and whilst he was paralyzed, the police allegedly asked him to move. He couldn't, and they got him and threw him onto the floor. So it's just, it's insanity. This is not a sane world. That's not a sane way to behave to someone who's just been paralyzed from unfortunately having a vaccine. And like I said, that is a rare event. I'm not saying it's happening all the time. No one's suggesting that. But I think what I'm really trying to say is, look, I understand the pressure that these people are under. And I understand that there are very, hot-headed people on both sides of the debate. You get anti-vaccine people, you get pro-vaccine people. I, like you and most others, we're kind of stuck in the middle trying to make sense of this. But we do need some. We just need people to start being more honest. And I think it's this industry we've got where people's jobs rely on the fact that they deliver the correct results. It becomes more like a corporation and a business rather than, say, a public health service. And this is the problem we've got. And I would ask them to search their own consciousness, to actually be a little bit more, rigorous and maybe a bit more honest in how this data are presented to the public.
Okay, Graham, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure as always. Look forward to the next time you're on the programme. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Mike.
And thank you for joining us. We will be back at 1 o'clock as usual, and we'll see you then. Bye-bye.